Can a French player creel three?
Well, I guess not. It's really rather boring. In fact, the trouble is not having a very, as I said, corporate mess life and being very a self-contained community. We weren't really frightfully good, I don't think, at entertaining other people. And our guest nights used to consist largely of just having people to dinner and then rather sitting around in the anteroom after dinner while the band went on playing outside, changing from sort of mildly classical to the latest tunes out from England. And then we used to sort of sit heavily around hoping the guests would go home soon. Really, we did feel that we weren't doing our best. And when we were in Meerut, a regiment, new infantry regiment arrived, we didn't know very well. And the reports were that they were slightly heavy in hand from people who'd called on them. And a brother officer and I wondered whether we couldn't liven the guest night up a bit. Well, that week we'd been to the cinema. We used to go to the cinema nearly six nights a week because there were three cinemas in Meerut and the films used to change twice. And there was nothing much to do after dinner, so we normally used to go to the cinema. And the films weren't too bad. Quite a lot of good films came. Anyway, we'd been to see a rather dull film. It was one of those films about New York equivalent of Fleet Street, about journalists, you know, sort of turned down hats and life on the paper and a lot of drink being consumed. And we saw two of these reporters in the film playing what we thought was a rather intriguing game, which is a game of draughts played with drinks. And one chap had whiskies and the other chap had gin. And they played draughts, and every time you took a piece, you drank it, you see. And we thought this game might well be adapted to after dinner to liven up the guest night. And as our expectations arrived, this regiment arrived on Master Dine. I suppose there were about a dozen of them came, or more probably, including the commanding officer. And after dinner, we suggested we might like to play that they might like to play this game, which we hadn't tried out before. We'd prepared a blackboard with chalked out. And we formulated some rules. And one side had a glass of port, and the other side had a glass of brandy. And then you tossed up to see who would play for the port and who would play for the brandy, depending on which you wanted to drink. And then we had to make the rule that only one person is actually allowed to touch the pieces, otherwise they tended to disappear off the board before the game was ended. And the others were only allowed to give him instructions as to what to do. And then the two sides were ranged up, and the two commanding officers on opposite sides in charge. And the game proceeded. And when you got a king, or whatever it's called in drafts, when you get to the end, you get a double. Then you put a double drink in the thing. And the only other drink rule was that the drink had to be consumed before the next move was made. And there are only 12 pieces. And so there's really only one drink per person on the thing. And I can't tell you what effect this had on the guest night. From then on, it was a complete riot. And all I can remember is that the commanding officer of the visiting regiment, went home with nothing on but his black bow tie driven away. And our guest nights greatly improved after that.
It sounds as though you could be quite easy with your commanding officers.
Well, yes, you see, in the mess, nobody has any rank in theory. Everyone's called by their Christian name, as long as you're not the newly last joined subaltern. You don't call the senior major by his Christian name the day, first day you meet. You wait until he intimates that, as you do with, you know, meeting anybody. Not nowadays, where everybody calls everybody by their Christian name and they don't know them at all. But only the colonel was called colonel, and only the colonel had any sort of due recognition in the mess, in that the colonel, who normally didn't come into the mess very much, but if he did come in, then everyone would stand up. But no, for nobody else, he wouldn't make a move for any other ranking officer coming in the mess, nor would you call anybody sir in the mess. But of course, if any outside person came in the most, then naturally you would stand up and entertain them as you would in your own home. And, of course, the colonel, it's a slightly... It's a very remote, lonely job, because one moment you've been on the Christian name to all your brother officers, and then the next moment you're the colonel, and the colonel to everybody. And it is a slightly remote affair. But, I mean, otherwise, it was easy. Well, I mean, the colonel was a friend like anybody else. I went shooting with him or played tennis with him. I've got a funny tennis story, actually. It's got nothing to do with the army in India, but the commanding officer when I joined was Lord Arthur Butler, who was later Lord Ormond. He was a very keen tennis player. And he was a very hard man physically, extremely tough. And he broke his leg once playing polo, but he didn't discover it until he got home, took his boot off. He went on playing. And also, he was impervious to heat and cold, which was very trying, because in the hot weather, he'd still be wearing a collar and tie when everybody else was in shirt sleeves. And in the cold weather, he'd still be wearing just a khaki drill jacket when everybody else was shivering in an overcoat. And he was always wondering why everybody else was grumbling about the heat or the cold. Anyway, he was a keen tennis player. He played in a curious way. He had no backhand. He played two-handed. He passed the racket from the right hand to the left. So he had a forehand on both sides. And also, he never played a volley, if he could help it. He was an extremely steady player and quite a difficult man to beat. And the subalterns used to be summoned to play tennis. We nearly all played, some of us keener and better than others. But anyway, the subalterns were always summoned to play tennis with the commanding officer, who liked his game of tennis about two or three times a week. And his wife, Lady Arthur, was a very waspish character, very terrifying, with a very sharp tongue, very funny actually, and amusing, but one of the very sharpest tongues I've ever heard, and had no hesitation in saying exactly what she thought about anybody and everybody. Very good it was for subalterns. Anyway, we went to play, and for some reason, Arthur Butler had bought a new kind of sock suspender, which he proudly showed us, which was an elastic with two clips on each end. One clip went onto the tail of the shirt and the other went onto the top of the sock. And he said how admirable this was for playing tennis, because it not only kept your socks up, but it also kept your shirt down and stopped it from rucking up. Whether his wife had bought them for him, whether he discovered them himself, I'm not quite sure. Anyway, we were duly shown these new sock suspenders when we started to play tennis. And somehow or other, it so happened that the colonel got lured to the net, a place which he wasn't very keen on playing. And somebody put a high lob up, and he jumped for it, thus stretching the sock suspender to its utmost. In fact, slightly beyond its utmost, because the bottom clip came off the sock, and the sock suspender rushed up his leg and bit him like an adder in a very vital place. It's the only time I ever saw him really show any signs of physical distress.
I think you told me earlier that you had a rather novel way, you and the other officers had a rather novel way of regulating behaviour in the mess.
Oh, I don't think it's very novel. I think it's quite a common thing in the army. It was a thing called the fine book. It was an admirable institution, because there are an awful lot of minor petty offences occur, like being improperly dressed on parade and being late and committing sort of unofficer-like crimes, like having the wrong sort of car, or so John Marling had a motorbike, which was thought to be very wrong for an officer in those days. Anyway, there was a thing called the fine book, which was kept in the mess. It had been running for many years. It was a leather-bound, handsome leather-bound book. And the theory was that anybody could fine anybody else for any conduct which was considered to be unbecoming or ungentlemanly or incorrect. And the only rule was that the fine must be ratified by the commanding officer. And it was normally a standard amount of 5 rupees, which was 7 and 6 pence, or 10 rupees, which was 15 bob in those days. Quite a small sum anyway. but merely the fact of having one's name ignominiously put there for everybody to read had a very good effect. And if you were improperly dressed, for instance, that same commanding officer, Jan Butler, going on church parade one Sunday, I think he probably bicycled down to church parade, went out through the hall, clapped his hat on his head, bicycled straight down to the parade, got off, walked on to parade, to be told sotto voce by his adjutant that he was wearing his civilian topi, no, not his military one. It was like appearing, you know, on parade in a bowler hat. And for that, he was put at the fine book by the adjutant, quite correctly so, and he had to ratify his own fine. And anything like that, the president of the mess committee for nasty food or paraffin in the soup or any unofficer-like behaviour or treachery on the part of one officer to another and so on. And they're all recorded. It makes wonderful reading. Unfortunately, that fine book, I think, was destroyed with a lot of regimental property in a fire in a warehouse where they were stored during the war. And I think that particular fine book has disappeared, but I've no doubt they've got one going since.
How was the mess financed?
The mess was financed by the officers paying their mess bills. I can't tell you exactly what the system was. I never had to run it. But I think a certain amount of your pay was sort of just went straight in as a subscription to the mess. And then you paid for any drinks you had and any extra things you did. Mess taxes and that sort of thing that we used to have. And any breakages and things were sort of shared round between everybody. There was a riot on a guest night or anything.
Did the officers get into debt very much?
Not if you could help it, because it got you into grave trouble getting into debt. It's a pretty serious crime getting into debt in the army, and bouncing checks or anything like that can lead to an officer being cashiered very remarkably quickly. So, well, I think we live pretty modestly, and I think we all try to live within our means. We were well paid, and in India, one didn't pay income tax on one's private income if you invested it sensibly. That certain stocks and shares were tax-free, as, for instance, war loan was tax-free in India. And therefore, and also, you know, one's pay went a good way. And there was no real excuse for getting into debt. We didn't gamble. We weren't allowed to gamble in my regiment for high stakes. We weren't allowed to play poker in barracks at all. We played poker in camp only, and only then for very small sums. There was none of the sort of high stake play which you get in some regiments, I know. And we didn't do anything to excess very much. We didn't drink a great deal. We didn't drink champagne all the time and so on. I think, you know, we lived very modestly and quietly. We spent most of our money on ponies and sport and modest motor cars, just enough to do the job.
What was the food like in mess?
We were all jolly good. It was very good indeed. We had very good cooks. The supply of food in India was very good in those days, and we had the only thing which is always difficult in India is bread, and it's quite difficult to get good bread. The Indians make bread with arrack or something instead of yeast, and it tastes horrible. But a good regiment would overcome such difficulties as that, you know, by either baking their own or getting it from the army and navy stores, or you know, right kind of sugar and so on. I can tell you a rather nice story about that. Show our rather la-di-da attitude to life. We sent a polo team to go up to, when we were in Meerut, we sent a polo team up to Dehradun out of season in the hot weather to play polo with the, I think it was the guides who had a depot up there. And they were invited to go up and play in this tournament, so we sent up four fairly good players, and they went up and returned. It was about 100 miles away. They returned early in the morning on Monday, arriving in time for breakfast. And there were several of us in the mess, and we didn't tend to talk much at breakfast. It wasn't encouraged. And so this lot came in. It was rather dusty from the journey. And the conversation went something like this. Did you win? Of course. What was it like? Hell. Cold milk in the coffee.
Did the uniform that you had prove very suitable for Indian climatic conditions?
Well, some of it was and some of it wasn't. It's all changed, of course, now, because during the war they discovered that there was no need to wear a topi to avoid sunstroke. And they gave up wearing topis in India, and they don't wear topis anymore. We had two kinds of hat for parade. The sort of pith helmet, which was a very light and rather thick hat made of lightweight pith or whatever helmet is made of. And then the smart hat was a thing called the Wolsey helmet, which I suppose had come from Sir Garnet Wolsey, which was a hideous thing with a sort of point in the front and a shovel-shaped neck over the back. It weighed a ton, and it was it sat too low on your head, and it was frightfully uncomfortable. And to wear it for 4 or 5 hours in a ceremonial parade was agony. Then otherwise we wore... in Secunderabad we wore khaki drill all the year round. And I don't think we wore shorts in the summer in Secunderabad. In Meerut we wore shorts in the summer. And we wore English service dress in the winter, when it was really quite cold. And the khaki drill was comfortable enough. It was always rather oppressive going on parade, because by the time you got on boots and breeches and a flannel shirt, the commanding officer was always changing the shirts. Every time you got a new commanding officer, he ordered a new shirt. So one ended up with dozens of shirts which didn't match anything and were out of date and couldn't be worn on this parade or that parade. And a sword and a Sam Brown. It could be very oppressive in the hot weather, when one had to wear, best clothes for guard mounting. But on the whole, the clothes were comfortable, and India was well supplied with washing facilities, so one had dozens of everything, and it was always clean nearly every day. You had about 5-6 pairs of breeches, and you only wore them 2 days, and then you had a clean pan. So on with shirts and everything else.
Was a great deal of attention paid to health and sanitation?
Well, I suppose so, yes. It was part of, being a good regiment. Everyone was responsible for it. And there wasn't a lot of disease, certain amount of jaundice. Soldiers used to get venereal disease, but I can't remember any officer getting it. There were the usual sort of... you had to keep pretty clean and healthy, because it was so hot in Meerut, we used to get a thing called prickly heat, which is very unpleasant, which is a nasty red rash which breaks out on any part of your body which sweats freely, and as all of you sweat freely in hot weather in north of India, it could be very uncomfortable, and there wasn't, I don't know what they've done about it now, but there wasn't at that time any really very satisfactory cure for it.
Did you fall sick yourself in India?
Well, I had my appendix removed while I was on the musketry course, and I got malaria very badly tiger shooting. Not malignant malaria, which remains with you for the rest of your life, so you keep on getting bouts of it, but quite bad. I lost 2.5 stone in weight or something like that before it was checked. Trouble was, we were right out miles in the jungle. We were something like 6 hours ride in a bullock cart from a railway station. It was a bit of a job to get back. We were both rather ill with him. And I think that's the only disease I had when I was younger, apart from minor injuries. People used to get killed playing polo occasionally. Two or three people I knew were killed. Very hard ground. We fell off. We were rather apt to get hurt.
Didn't you say that you got jaundice?
Yes, I got jaundice once. That was also fairly common.
How do you think that you got that?
Well, I don't know. No idea. It's an infective disease. It's largely caused by bad washing up. It's supposed to be.
Can you tell me what your daily routine was? Can you take me through a kind of typical day from about what time you would get up and the things you would do until
First thing in the morning, your bearer would arrive with a cup of tea, if you like that thing, and a plate with a banana, a very small banana, and two biscuits on it, and that would start the day. You'd then get up and shave and wash and put on your clothes, and your bearer always put on your boots and things for you. And then you'd go on first parade before breakfast normally, except in the winter, in the cold winter in the north, but normally speaking, all riding was done before breakfast. You'd do about 2 hours, but probably about 7 o'clock on parade, so you'd have to get up about 6:15. 7 till 8:30, 9:15, and then your horse would go back to the stables, and you would have a quick bath or shower and take off your riding clothes and go to breakfast in the mess on your bicycle probably, and read the paper, and then about an hour later you would go down to stables, and morning stables would last anything up to about 2.5 hours. The horses were groomed and cleaned and groomed again and polished and everything else. And then there would probably be an hour of something, like office work or instruction in something or some lecture on something or other. And then it would be lunch. And then after lunch, if there was nothing doing, you would retire, everybody would retire for a kind of siesta for about a couple of hours or an hour and a half, because that was really the hottest part of the day. And then in the afternoon there would be evening stables, but the officers didn't attend evening stables. Only a sort of skeleton party of soldiers went down to deal with that. And sport would be the thing, polo, 3 days a week, Mondays, Wednesdays and Fridays. Thursday was a half holiday, so you'd go sailing or shooting or fishing, play tennis, Saturday, Sunday. Saturday and Sunday we generally used to go somewhere, go out for a picnic or go sightseeing or shooting or something like that. And then dark, about 6:30, you would retire to your bungalow, perhaps go and have a drink with somebody or ask somebody in for a drink with you, or just stay at home, take it easy. Dinner, go out to the cinema perhaps, go to the club, play billiards, off to bed. An alternative to riding would be musketry, which played a very large part in our lives, because incessant hours and hours on the ranges. And there, instead of going riding, you would go off and you'd either be the officer in the butts where you marked up the targets, or officer on the firing point where you controlled the details for firing. And very boring it was. I mean, you spent literally hours, and that would probably be very late for breakfast. It was probably gone for 2.5, 3 hours. And you probably had to go back again after breakfast again for more of it. And the same thing over and over again. You've got 700 people and they've got to shoot, you know, through a whole table of different ranges and different types of rapid fire and this fire and that fire and the other thing. You're at it the whole year round pretty well, and very dull it was too.
You pointed out how important sport was. in your spare time. What other things did you do with your spare time apart from sport?
Well, we were quite good about going sightseeing. We used to go off expeditions. There's an awful lot to see in India. And there are all these old forts and palaces and ruins and this, that, and the other. We went to all the sort of stock places like the caves of Ellora, marvelous rock-cut caves. The forts, and then the normal places like the Taj Mahal and so on and so forth.
I
But we
think
spent an awful lot of our time shooting or fishing or playing polo or riding or pig sticking. Pig sticking was a hot weather sport. Normally the polo players functioned, you see, from September till March. And then they didn't go on leave during that time, so they took their leave actually playing polo. Whereas pig sticking started in the hot weather, March, April, May, until the rains came. And so the pig stickers tended to take their leave in the winter and go hunting in England. And then they came back and went pig sticking in the hot weather.
what was the system of leaving cards in India?
Oh, well, it was quite a standard thing. I mean, it was merely a way of making oneself known to people without actually having to inflict oneself on them. All married officers had a box at their gate, like a letterbox. And the subalterns, newly joined people or newly arrived in the station, they used to go around and pop your card in the box. And they then knew that Lieutenant Snooks of the Fusiliers had arrived and was available for invitation to dinner or lunch or drinks or whatever was wanted. And of course, all the establishment, like the Commander-in-Chief and the Resident and the Governor-General and the Viceroy and the Maharaja of this and so on, they all had books.